Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. This hour, we'll talk about the cost of childcare. In some cases, it exceeds rent and mortgage payments. It's led some families to limit the number of children they have, what one community is considering to deal with the problem. Republican lawmakers want Illinois to follow a presidential executive order that bans transgender girls from competing in girls' sports. We'll also listen to concerns over the future of the Great Lakes and how politics could get in the way of long-standing agreements to protect the bodies of water. A new museum in Illinois tells the story of public housing. And as more colleges and universities offer full tuition scholarship programs, we examine how they work. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Republican state lawmakers have signaled they want to ban transgender girls from competing on girls' sports teams in Illinois. This comes after President Trump signed an executive order to narrow the definition of women protected by Title IX to include only cisgender women. The Illinois High School Association says it allowed three transgender girls to compete in girls' sports last year. We have more from Eric Stock.
Illinois Senate Republicans have sent a letter to U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi asking for guidance on Illinois' policy on transgender athletes playing in girls' sports under Title IX. That's the landmark federal law that bars gender discrimination in public education. Republicans said they got a confusing statement from the IHSA. The association says it can't follow the federal executive order since the Illinois Human Rights Act dictates transgender athletes cannot be restricted from playing in sports with their chosen gender. Republican lawmakers say that's not fair. State Senator Sally Turner of Logan County interprets women in Title IX to include only cisgender women, arguing that transgender people have a different biological makeup.
And this isn't anything political. I think this is just the way people should recognize that women need to have their own area in sports. And I think that's the right thing to do. It's about protecting people and making sure that they're getting the safety that they need in order to play sports fairly.
Ann Turner says she wants to protect the legacy of female athletes who paved the way for Title IX.
We as women fought hard for Title IX to be recognized in the sports field. And we fought very hard for that. And I think that's really important that we continue to look at it in that fashion, that women's sports is something that women need to be participating in.
Turner says people in her mostly rural district support banning transgender girls from competing in girls' sports. Turner's district includes parts of Bloomington Normal and stretches to near Peoria, Springfield, and Decatur. A few miles from Turner's district, an organization based in Bloomington Normal and Peoria vehemently opposes the message Republican lawmakers are sending. Selena Pappas is a spokesperson for Central Illinois Friends, a nonprofit that provides a space and support for people in the LGBTQ+ community. Pappas says the letter is meant to bully the trans community and distract from real issues affecting women.
We are focusing on this tiny subsect of people, on isolating them, on removing them from public existence, on keeping them down when there are far more important issues.
Pappas says transgender teenagers are already marginalized on top of the anxieties that often come with growing up.
When you isolate a person, that has a negative effect on their emotional development, right? There are numerous studies that you can go out there and find about how laws like this negatively affect the mental health of transgender youth.
Nearly half of transgender youth in Illinois seriously considered suicide and 15% attempted it last year, according to the nonprofit The Trevor Project. Pappas says sports are not only a space to compete, but also to develop as a person.
Transgender person being able to participate in youth sports is the same reason that all youth participate in sport. Kids go to sports for socialization, and that is the same for kids whether they are cisgender or whether they are transgender, right? It's about being able to build community.
A couple days after Republicans sent the letter to the Attorney General with no response, Republican State Representative Regan Deering called for a legislative fix. Deering, who represents parts of Bloomington Normal, pushed a bill to ban transgender girls from playing on girls' sports teams.
And if we have gender-confused athletes that are looking to compete, you know, there are opportunities for them. But our legislation talks about sanctioned sports, and we're trying to create an opportunity to maintain these biological females' right to compete in their sports, to win awards, to gain scholarships, and continue to have a career and a camaraderie.
Deering's bill would create co-ed teams for transgender athletes. Deering filed the bill soon after she took office in January. It's never been given a hearing. With reporting from WGLT State Capitol correspondent Cesar Toscano, I'm Eric Stock.
More and more Illinois colleges and universities are offering full tuition scholarships. Almost everyone's got one now. But as nice as zero tuition sounds, how do those work? Peter Midland tells us more.
Saida Bairami is a junior at Dixon High School who spends a lot of time volunteering. She helps out at Little League games, food drives, and she's even shucked some corn.
One time that was kind of special to me, I went out to this church and we were cooking and putting together a meal to give away later. And it was just a little bit of a small group, and it was just so nice being able to sit there and do things knowing I'm helping other people out.
She says it's helped her to get to know her community, and it's also helped her earn a full tuition scholarship at Sauk Valley Community College through their Impact program. Students in Sauk Valley's district, like Bairami, sign up before their freshman year of high school. And unlike many zero tuition scholarships, there's no GPA or income requirement, but they do have to complete 25 hours of community service every year. Lori Cortez with Sauk says the Impact program launched in 2021, so the first big cohort of students will arrive at the college this summer.
We are projecting a 20% increase in enrollment because of the Impact program.
And aside from its impact on Sauk Valley, Cortez says students like Bairami have made a massive impact on the area. Since launch, students have logged over 58,000 hours of community service across 240 nonprofits.
We've had several nonprofits tell us that their nonprofit services would have been closed if it wasn't for the Impact program.
But how does Sauk Valley pay for the program? Well, Cortez says it's all local fundraising, from small family donations to an anonymous $1 million donor. Other zero tuition scholarships in Northern Illinois look very different. At Northern Illinois University, they first launched Husky Pledge back in 2019, and they funded it through a new state grant called Aim High. Husky Pledge does have GPA and family income thresholds, but NIU's Sol Jensen says some of that criteria has changed quite a bit since the program started.
The income was at $75,000. Now we're up to $115,000 of a family income.
He says they could increase that income requirement because the state increased AIM High allocations. Now, these scholarships can reach middle-income students, too. Kyle Westbrook with NIU's Ed Systems Center says middle-income families can often find themselves in financial aid no man's land.
That student is probably not going to qualify for any financial aid, and yet their parents never made enough money to, you know, sock away $400,000 to fund their college experience.
But it's not just public colleges and universities either. Now, North Central College, a small private university in Naperville, has a new Cardinal Pledge program. Its tagline, tuition-free, debt-free, stress-free, not too good to be true. Aggie Haney with North Central says that came from conversations with students.
They felt like it's a catch, right? It's a bait and switch of some sort. Like there's something to it. It can't be true. It's too good to be true.
She says the college did increase merit scholarship funds to help pay for it. And to meet the criteria, students must qualify for the federal Pell Grant and the state MAP Grant. Students who qualify for federal aid are often already eligible for many grants and scholarships, even without these Pledge and Promise programs. But NIU's Jason Klein says, on top of potentially saving money, they also help cut through the noise and simplify the financial aid process. Most students don't know their family's gross adjusted income off the top of their head. Once they apply to schools, they don't know until pretty late in the process how much financial aid they'll actually receive and how much they'll have to pay out of pocket. Klein says these full tuition scholarships aren't just good marketing for marketing's sake. They can actually offer families some clarity about how expensive college will really be. If you qualify for Pell, zero tuition, that's it. Rockford Promise is yet another zero tuition scholarship, but this one is regional. As you could probably guess, it's solely for Rockford students. But Aurora Schnorr with Rockford Promise says scholarships aren't just limited to one school.
Regular graduating seniors have Rockford University, NIU, and then RVC. And then we have a transfer option that's launching this year for St. Anthony College of Nursing.
When Rockford Promise started giving out full tuition awards back in 2016, they handed out 5. Schnorr says they've grown a lot since then.
Just under 500 for how many are in school with us right now. And then I think we're at about 170 graduated.
The program operates on a variety of funding sources, from local fundraising to support from the city of Rockford. They were able to expand Rockford University scholarships this year thanks to a partnership with the city using revenue from the new Hard Rock Casino. So, do these programs save students money? Yes, they all include at least some new scholarship funding, but how much will it save them? Well, that depends on the pledge, promise, or commitment they're being made. I'm Peter Mudlin.
The Conservation Reserve Program is one of the largest voluntary land conservation initiatives in the U.S. More than 26 million acres of grassland and former cropland are enrolled, but landowners and conservationists worry the program could be under threat as the Trump administration shrinks the federal government and deprioritizes conservation efforts. For Harvest Public Media, Molly Ashford has the story.
When a storm unleashed devastating flooding across Nebraska in 2019, Judith Punchikar watched as part of her family's farm was reclaimed by the Middle Loup River.
When the rain came down so hard, this land just washed right into the river. That was my land all the way to the dead trees. So that's 8 acres here that I lost.
The Punchikar family has owned the small farm just outside of St. Paul, Nebraska for more than a century. By the time Punchikar returned to live on the farm full-time in 2020, she knew she needed to do something to prevent further erosion. When she called the local Farm Service Agency office for advice, they told her about a federal program they administer called the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP. Now, most of the 153 acres of her farm are enrolled in that program.
I think I'm the only farm in the area that has my entire farm in the CRP program. We're not talking a whole lot of acres, but that's a lot of acres for me.
The CRP was established in the 1985 Farm Bill with the goal of reducing soil erosion. Landowners receive an annual rental payment for taking environmentally sensitive land out of production for 10 to 15 years. They then implement conservation practices, which the government helps pay for. Jesse Womack, a policy specialist at the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, says the program has become a mainstay of the rural landscape.
It does so much for quality of life in rural communities. It offers farmers an alternative means of cash flow if they have acreage that, needs rest, isn't the most productive.
In the current political climate, some wonder if CRP will survive. The program is under the Farm Service Agency, which is part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA, like many federal agencies, has been hit hard by layoffs and funding cuts. And Project 2025, the blueprint for a second Trump administration, explicitly called for the CRP program to be eliminated.
I think that the actions of the last few months have clearly illustrated that there is nothing that is not on the table.
That's Zachary Ducheneau, who led the Farm Service Agency in former President Joe Biden's administration. He worries the program could be targeted by the current administration during Farm Bill negotiations. And even if CRP survives, Ducheneau says recent firings and funding cuts have already stretched the Farm Service Agency to the breaking point.
There is no way the department or the agency is going to be able to tighten its belt or streamline or find efficiencies just because someone says so.
There are other signs that federal support for CRP is lagging. The annual sign-up for the program hasn't been announced yet. A USDA spokesperson says the agency is, quote, evaluating conservation goals and priorities. And funding authority for the CRP runs out in September with the expiration of the Farm Bill extension. Still, Jesse Womack says he'd be surprised if the program was eliminated. He grew up hunting on CRP land in Minnesota and says the program has broad support from hunters, environmentalists, and farmers alike.
I would find it shocking if there was not some bipartisan collaboration to protect CRP if a material threat emerged.
Back on Punchakar's farm in Nebraska, a woodpecker drums on a large oak tree. Though the conservation practices are still in their early stages, Punchakar says she's already noticing a difference.
And the seeds are just getting started, but I have never seen so many pollinators before, so many different kinds of wasps and different kinds of bees.
Since her CRP contracts were signed recently, Punchakar knows she will continue to be paid for her work over the next decade. But she hopes the conservation projects on her farm will last far longer. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Molly Ashford.
Galesburg's Orpheum Theater now has a digital projector, and that's thanks to the generosity of another theater. Parisi Imtiaz has more.
The digital projector is important because it will allow the Orpheum to screen a wider range of movies. Andrew Driscoll is the Orpheum's executive director. He says the Paramount Theater in Charlottesville, Virginia, initially looked to sell the projector. The Orpheum was interested in it and raised $5,000 through anonymous donors. But the projector was worth around $70,000. So Driscoll told them the Orpheum could not afford it.
A few months later, they got back and said they've talked about it, and they decided that they are going to go ahead and donate the projector as long as we pay for the shipping and everything to get it to us from Charlottesville.
The funds raised locally were then put towards the packaging and shipping costs. Driscoll says the projector is just like the one used by the local AMC theater in Galesburg.
To have something that is going to be that quality here in a venue like the Orpheum that has such a rich history in film, that then brings in the opportunity for us to show more current movies in a much better quality, visual quality than we had before. It's amazing.
The Orpheum will debut its new projector with the Over the Rainbow movie series. The Wizard of Oz will play on the evening of Friday, May 16th, followed by Wicked on Saturday, May 17th.
The lyric in Somewhere Over the Rainbow, that dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. And this was a dream of ours to have a projector like this that has come true.
Driscoll says the Paramount Theater has a staff of nearly 20 people, while the Orpheum has a staff of 5. He says it's just amazing that the Paramount staff was willing to take a resource that was no longer of great use to them and bless another organization with it. I'm Parise Imtiaz.
We have more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. One of America's first examples of public housing is the Jane Addams Homes in Chicago, built in 1938 and named for the trailblazing reformer. Fast forward, there are now some 1 million public housing units in the U.S., and the Addams Homes are getting a second act as a museum dedicated to telling the story of public housing. Allison Cuddy reports.
Public housing has taken many forms, from high-rises to single-family homes. The National Public Housing Museum is housed in a three-story red brick building in the heart of Chicago's historic Little Italy neighborhood. Inside and out, everything looks brand new. The curvy Art Deco metal balconies are freshly painted. Large, multi-paned windows flood the interior with light. There are exhibitions, a recording studio, art installations, even a small room where visitors can spin records made by people who lived in public housing. On the second floor, Executive Director Lisa Yun Lee leads a group through a trio of apartments furnished in historic period detail from the 1930s to the 1970s.
Feel free to take a seat.
Nobody wants to sit on the furniture. You can totally sit on the furniture.
I'll sit on the furniture.
Sit on the furniture.
In the small living room, a green striped couch sits next to an end table covered with framed family photos and a page from a war ration book. The kitchen floor has checkerboard linoleum. These details, plus oral histories, evoke the presence of the real people who lived here across the decades, like a Jewish family, one of the earliest residents.
So, this was Inez Turvitz. She was such a lovely character.
From a vintage cathedral-style radio, the recorded voice of Inez's niece, Tina Turovitz-Birnbaum, recalls her family's story.
my bubby Molly and Zadie, settled on the south side of Chicago. But when the Great Depression hit, they, like many other people, needed an affordable place to live, and they heard about the Jane Addams homes.
In the 1930s, public housing held promise for many. Returning veterans, immigrants, and others found community there. Many still do. In the History Lessons exhibition, Education Ambassador Gentry Quinones points to objects donated by former and current public housing residents, including Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who lived in public housing as a child.
She told her story of living in the projects in New York City, and she was gracious enough to share some pictures with us.
By the 1960s and 70s, public housing came to be seen in a negative light, as places where poverty, crime, and segregation were concentrated and persisted. Disinvestment left the buildings in disrepair. Lee says the museum wants to change the narrative about public housing then and now, without exploiting images or stories of suffering, which she calls poverty porn.
How do you tell traumatic stories so that you don't re-traumatize people? How do you tell these tragic stories so that people listen with empathy?
For Lee and her staff, the answer is simple. Start with the experiences of residents. Their stories are woven throughout the museum, including their role in its origins. In the late 90s, as Chicago began to tear down its public housing, demolishing around 25,000 units, some public housing residents waged a long and hard-won fight to save this building, hoping it could be a place to tell their story. It took decades before their idea for a museum was approved. Abandoned since 2002, a lot of work was required to bring this building back to life. Francine Washington is on the board of the museum. She says the museum does reflect her experiences as a public housing resident. She hopes it challenges stereotypes.
I love this place. This is a place called home. People get to see our plight, to see that we have the same blood type, they want the same thing in our life that they want.
The need for affordable housing remains. The waiting list for public housing in Chicago is over 100,000 people. It can take years or even decades to get in. The museum wants to intervene in that reality. It offers paid workforce development programs for public housing residents. Some may even live there in one of 15 mixed-income housing units in a wing of the building separate from the museum. Lee says all of it is critical to the museum's mission to advocate for housing as a human right.
We believe that in order to preserve history, you have to make it relevant to the most critical social justice issues of today, and that there is no way that we can actually address any of the social issues that we want to unless we go back in time and ask what have we not yet learned from history.
That's a question that Lee and others hope the National Public Housing Museum will help people answer. For NPR News, I'm Allison Cuddy in Chicago.
The Great Lakes make up the largest freshwater ecosystem on the planet. The U.S. and Canada have a long-standing history of co-managing the bodies of water. With rising political tensions between the two nations, the future of the Great Lakes hangs in the balance. Esther Yunji King spoke with Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ's reporter on climate change, and Elena Harkness, CEO of Current, a Chicago-based water technology innovation hub.
Let's start with you, Elena. What do we use the Great Lakes for?
Well, Esther, we use the Great Lakes, in short, for everything. Our economies depend on them, our public health, the well-being of our communities. All of this depends on the Great Lakes. We use them for drinking water. 21% of the world's fresh surface water is tied right up here in the biggest freshwater ecosystem on the planet. And we depend on it for our lives and for our livelihoods, in short. So all of us here in Chicago and in the Great Lakes region are benefiting from these Great Lakes.
You mentioned the drinking water. How many people does the Great Lakes supply water to?
Yeah. Great Lakes in U.S. and Canada combined, more than 40 million people depend on the Great Lakes for drinking water. And we also use that drinking water for industrial purposes. So really, you can think about this as the public health, the ecosystem health, and the economic health of our region.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the ecosystem?
Yeah, so when I think about the Great Lakes ecosystem, the first thing you need to think about is it's called what economists would call a common pool resource, right? So think of it as a big pool that we cannot put a fence around, and we can't determine how other people are going to use it. So we really need to have collaborative frameworks to manage it in common. This ecosystem includes rivers that feed it, precipitation that resupplies it, but it also includes all of the, aquatic ecosystems that depend on it, as well as the human and economic ecosystems that depend on it. So it's really one big vital resource that's sustaining us all.
Well, someone's going to manage this. Juan Pablo, what does managing the Great Lakes really mean? And who's currently doing it?
Yeah, Esther, like we've been saying, the Great Lakes are a massive ecosystem. So we're talking about a pretty big job, which essentially comes down to maintaining the physical, the biological, the chemical integrity of the waters of the Great Lakes. This is a big collaboration. It includes everything from water quality protection, habitat restoration, climate change mitigation, and handling the threats of things like pollution and invasive species.
And so what are some of the agencies or departments that manage these lakes, both on the American side and the Canadian side?
Sure. This is a team effort. So this means the EPA, that's the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the USGS, that's the Geological Survey, NOAA, the Canadian counterparts. But then there's also the International Joint Commission, which is kind of like a collaborative between the U.S. and Canada to resolve any sort of water disputes.
Well, there's got to be some sort of agreement in place to make all of this work well. What is that agreement right now between the two countries?
Well, there's technically quite a few. But going back to what I just mentioned, the IJC, which is established kind of on the main one, that's the Boundary Waters Treaty. That treaty was signed by Canada and the United States over 100 years ago in 1909. So we're talking about a long-standing agreement, right? The treaty, like I mentioned, established the International Joint Commission, which handles disputes over water shared between the two countries.
And how has it worked? I mean, how has that relationship been good so far?
Yeah, I'd say so. For a long time, for over 100 years, the co-governance of the Great Lakes has worked relatively really well. In fact, some people I spoke to for my story called it the gold standard of how sovereign nations share a water resource. Like, this relationship in particular is the example that water policy specialists point to when they want to make the point.
Wow.
Right now, a lot is changing, and a lot is changing very quickly as the Trump administration runs its campaign to slash the federal workforce, cut regulatory agencies, cut budgets that monitor the Great Lakes, for example. So now scientists and policy advocates are just waiting to see what's left standing once the dust settles.
Well, there's also a thing called the Great Lakes Day Summit, right? What happened this year at that summit?
There sure is. Yeah, the Great Lakes Day is this annual summit that politicians and officials of all stripes gather in Washington, D.C. for to effectively make the case for the largest freshwater ecosystem on the planet. So for years, every March, the event has occurred without a hitch. This is without incident. Pretty good stuff. But last month, amid the tariff dispute between Canada and the United States, two Canadian mayors were abruptly disinvited from this long-standing White House meeting tied to the summit.
Yeah. Really happened. I was there.
Wow. Well, what are the political implications of that decision? I mean, how can you uninvite people who have been there for years?
Well, how can you? They sure did. They did it one way or the other. And you know, that diplomatic snub took on a bigger significance amid the Trump administration's recent position. So, sure, there was the tariff dispute between Canada and the U.S., but also talk of Canada becoming the 51st state, a literal direct challenge to Canada's sovereignty. But also, not long before that, the New York Times reported that President Trump, in an early February call with then-Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, said that he wanted to revisit the sharing of the lakes and rivers between the two nations. So a bunch of Great Lakes advocates immediately worried that that snub was a warning sign that one of the world's most successful examples of water sharing could become collateral damage in President Trump's campaign to reshape American foreign policy.
Elena, let's get back to you here. What role do NGOs play in all of this?
Yeah, a really important brokering role, right, between the public resources that we depend on to manage these Great Lakes. Juan Pablo talked about science investments, but it's also the infrastructure in common and the economic frameworks that provide for this, like, really vital resource to turn into benefits for our communities. Nonprofits provide an advocacy role. They are often communicating and creating a public education and awareness campaign for people. There are all sorts of ways that they contribute to this environment. One runs something called the Value of Water campaign. This is just public polling to understand how Americans feel about the need to invest in water. And they've just put out their 2025 results. And at a time when bipartisan consensus priorities are few, more than 92% of respondents said that they care about water and they feel that we need to invest more in it. So, I mean, this huge support for public investments in water. So that's just one of the roles that NGOs play in all of this. The other is in helping to administer really important projects funded through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. These are efforts to actually restore and, you know, reclaim parts of the Great Lakes system that have been degraded over time. NGOs are often closest to the communities that really know how to shape these projects in ways that are going to bring most benefits for ecosystems and people.
Well, you lead Current, the Chicago-based Water Technology Innovation Hub. So talk to us a little bit about what your organization is doing.
Our mission is to grow a prosperous blue economy here in our region, help accelerate adoption of innovative water technologies, and solve pressing water challenges. So for quite some time, we've been really focused on the idea that the Great Lakes could be using this globally significant water as a way to attract business and people to a region that has lost industry and population over time, right? We're a place that can sustain a lot more economic opportunity and a lot more residential density than we have today. So we've been thinking about what needs to happen in order to preserve the Great Lakes in perpetuity and to steward them effectively in a time when there may be more demand on our water resources than there are today. So this moment in time when the essential collaborative governance structure between Canada and the U.S. and all the states, right? This is the Great Lakes Compact is really a states and provincial leadership agreement, right? We need those to be in place so that we can have conversations about what this long-term future looks like, where we can have more water-intensive industry locating here, more jobs for people, and still use that water to feed, you know, the health of our population and the health of our aquatic ecosystems that really depend on it.
So it sounds like it's not just important to kind of what life and what society is being sustained right now, but also the future of the region, it sounds like.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And to come back to this idea that this is a resource we share in common, we can't threaten Canada with cutting off access to the Great Lakes, right? It is a fact on the ground that these Great Lakes cross two different countries, right? And this is true all over the world. And we know undisputably that with common pool resources, we can either have a race to the bottom where we mismanage them. And we've seen this happen in watersheds all over the world. And that's where we decide that we're just going to use as much as works for the United States, right? You can have conflict over that water, or you can have strong collaborative, coordinated governance agreements that preserve, you know, in perpetuity for long-term sustainability, that shared common pool resource. And that's very much what we need to see continue if we're going to be able to benefit economically and, you know, ecologically from the Great Lakes for a long time to come.
You know, you mentioned a water-intensive industry. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. Manufacturing, which has been in the news a lot these days because the current administration is really interested in the idea that manufacturing should come back to the United States and we should onshore it here or we should nearshore it with our trading partners in Canada and Mexico. That's interesting because today, not a lot of manufacturing is happening in North America relative to the rest of the world. So if we imagine a scenario where manufacturing comes back to the Great Lakes region, that could be a good thing because, again, we can sustain more than we have today and we do need quality jobs and it would be great to be producing things that are really helpful for the long-term competitiveness and national security of our country right here in North America. But to do that, we need to have long-term stewardship and governance frameworks for the Great Lakes in place so that we don't end up in this race to the bottom scenario.
Well, you said that you were at the Great Lakes Day Summit and just, you know, I'm sure you saw all of the sort of the surprise there, but talk to us a little bit more about what's at stake with Trump's federal plans.
So we have to think about, again, the investments that the federal government makes in things that have no other source of support. We can't replace federal support for basic R&D and science with private sector support because the R&D that's going into things like finding the new technologies that are going to help us clean our water, get things like PFAS out of our water and recover critical minerals, that's not going to come from the private sector alone. These are new technologies. They take a long time to develop And public investment in R&D is essential to keep that innovation engine going. The second thing that's really important is public investments in infrastructure. Again, this is something that enjoys an extremely high level of bipartisan support. Most people believe we should be spending public dollars on infrastructure. And so those infrastructure investments are needed to get the lead out of our water. They're needed to keep drinking water flowing and to deal with our wastewater. And so making sure we have the federal funds available to do that infrastructure investment is key. And then there's, you know, all of the other economic arrangements that the federal government has historically played a role in will be really important to helping think through, again, sustainability of water-intensive industries like manufacturing, but also, you know, where we're locating things like data centers that are incredibly important in fueling almost every aspect of the economy today.
That's Elena Harkness, CEO of Current, a Chicago-based water technology innovation hub, and Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ reporter on climate change. Thank you both.
Thanks, Esther.
Thanks, Esther.
More to come on Statewide. We'll be right back. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Indiana's governor has signed a bill that creates a commission to study redrawing Indiana and Illinois' state lines. The commission will have 6 appointees from Indiana. It calls for 5 people from Illinois, but that won't happen because the Illinois legislature has not even passed their bill out of committee. Republican Representative Brad Holbrook authored the Illinois legislation. He says it's unfortunate it didn't get out of committee, but says it's not surprising.
We need to have that conversation to say these are the issues. The General Assembly needs to take this seriously and address them and turn Illinois into a destination state rather than a state to exit.
33 counties in Illinois have passed symbolic referendums about creating a new state separate from Chicago since 2020. Ketamine has been used for decades as a sedative in hospital settings. It can also be used for mental health care, but it's not widely available for therapeutic uses, as Melissa Ellen tells us more.
Before Marie tried ketamine for her mental health, she says she was deeply depressed and anxious. She could barely get out of bed most days and considered herself passively suicidal.
Which means that it's always an option, but you don't have a plan.
Marie is a Peoria resident. She's being identified by her middle name, so potential employers do not learn of her treatment. She says she has tried nearly every antidepressant available.
I've been on less antidepressants than I have diets, but I also have diet resistant fat.
After just 6 ketamine infusions, Marie says her anxiety and depression began to improve. She recalls once when she was having a panic attack and...
Not only was it not as intense as my panic attacks usually were, but it was also not as long. I was able to pull myself out of the panic attack.
Mental health providers across central Illinois who offer ketamine treatment say they've seen patients go through similar transformations. But only a handful of clinics offer the service, and additional barriers can prevent access for people who need it most. WGLT found only 5 providers in the area offer ketamine therapy.
It's absolutely not enough, and people aren't well-versed in ketamine therapy.
That's Stagney Michael. She owns Occult Mental Health in Tremont in Tazewell County, which offers both ketamine and Spravato. The latter is a nasal spray esketamine. It has slight molecular differences to ketamine, but produces the same effects. Michael also works in a local hospital. She says seeing people become inpatient for mental health inspired her to explore ketamine therapy.
It's like, how do I keep my patients out of the hospital? What is the best options for my patients to help them tackle a treatment-resistant depression or depression in general? And the research is showing it's ketamine.
Someone like Marie, who tried multiple prescription antidepressants, is what providers define as having treatment-resistant depression. And the Anxiety and Depression Association has actually endorsed ketamine as a, quote, breakthrough drug for these mental illnesses. Michael says 80 to 90% of her clients who have tried ketamine therapy have not had another depressive episode. She says intravenous ketamine is also great for suicidal ideation.
Usually within 20 minutes of an infusion, those thoughts have subsided. So it's pretty exciting because there's nothing else on the market that does that.
Janet Albertson is a co-owner and operator of Genesis Infusion Center, which has sites in Peoria and once weekly in Bloomington. She says the demand for ketamine has been present in central Illinois for some time.
I draw patients from Decatur, Champaign, Springfield, so I have quite a bit of draw.
Unlike occult mental health, Genesis only offers intravenous ketamine. Albertson says she does not offer Spravato because she thinks there's less control. For one, people have to take an entire dose at once. So
if you give the second one and they're having a bad trip, they just have to ride it out.
Ketamine is known to have hallucinogenic effects, and Albertson says it's not uncommon for people to need a break. With intravenous ketamine, she can provide that.
If someone starts getting a little overwhelmed, I can stop it immediately, and it starts easing up in just a couple of minutes.
However, intravenous ketamine is not covered by insurance. Only Spravato is, because that's the only form of ketamine the Food and Drug Administration has approved for mental health. The three providers offering intravenous ketamine in central Illinois all charge under $450 per session. Albertson says she understands the cost is prohibitive, but insurance can be even more so.
They're going to try to control it. They're going to impose many, many more rules and regulations and possibly limit the number of treatments people can have.
Albertson says she does not want that type of interference. Her client Marie says she understands where Albertson is coming from. After all, it was after her sixth consecutive infusion in 2 weeks that she started to improve. But Marie says the more people who can access the drug, the better. And insurance coverage is a huge boost.
I mean, you only get one chance at life. And laying in bed all day wishing you were dead isn't a very fun way to spend it.
That is why she and her husband are willing to pay the price. At Grit and Grace Therapy in Mahomet, near Champaign, Jessica McClellan says she finds insurance coverage for Spravato highly appealing. Her clinic is one of three that carries the drug in central Illinois. She says navigating insurance providers can be a slog, but
typically if somebody wants it, we do get it approved.
McClellan adds she thinks there are a lot of misconceptions about people who use ketamine for therapeutic purposes. She says not enough people know about the good it can do, and it's certainly not about getting high.
Why would you want to pay, especially if you are in that field, why would you want to pay to go somewhere just to get high for a couple of hours? And it's just so much more than that.
Now, several months into her treatment, Marie says she has changed so much. She's getting out of bed more easily and is much less anxious. She says she considers ketamine therapy as one of the resources available to help her manage her mental health.
Medications are a tool. And the ketamine, it's a tool.
Though she used to be deadly afraid of singing in public, she's gearing up for a performance.
Melissa Ellen with that report. Child care costs are a problem everywhere. McLean County, where Bloomington Normal is located, has the fourth highest average cost for child care in the state, behind suburban Chicago counties. That cost is becoming a barrier to community growth. Bloomington Normal's Economic Development Council's Patrick Hoban says the council started getting anecdotal reports that the cost of child care was exceeding rent or mortgage payments. He told reporter Charlie Schlinker they did a survey to determine if the evidence amplified or contradicted the narrative.
It amplified it. It's one thing to have a testimony from somebody. It's another thing to look at some of the bigger data sets that are out there. The Department of Labor has a really good one. And then hearing directly from the providers and what their challenges are. I didn't realize how far it went. This is not what I do day to day. We're here to do industrial and commercial deals. But we realize that without proper childcare, then you're not untapping some potential workers. So that the data definitely from the bigger data sets along with this smaller study just echoed exactly what we thought in the testimonials.
What does the local study say?
The study says that the child care costs are exorbitant, and it really has to do with the rapid growth that we've seen in wages recently. My wife was a child care provider as well, and I always found it fascinating how little they got paid for how important the role was. Here recently with rapid growth in Rivian and Ferrero, you can make more money to kind of counter inflation at some of those places. So they're losing a lot of the workers. And recently, rightfully so, their minimum wage for childcare workers has gone to $18 an hour. Well, it's hard to keep lower costs whenever 70% of the cost of childcare is in the wages. So you combine that with the requirements for the education and licensing that they have to keep up. And it's really just, it's pushed the price up above $2,000 a month in some instances.
What's the average?
The average that we saw for a center is about $1,600 a month or $400 a week, which is still higher than a lot of people's rent.
And for a private daycare provider?
Out of the home providers, it's about half. So it's coming in closer to $800. And we found out that was really due to the lack of benefits that they provide their workers, or sometimes it's just one person.
Are there slots available? Is there a shortage as well?
There is still a shortage. It's not as short as it used to be. We've also seen that some of them can be, I think the waiting list for infants is the largest one, and that there's still like 90 people on the waiting list. And so one of the things that we've been asked is that anyone that is considering to become pregnant or adopt, contact the centers immediately and say, because people make the mistakes of waiting 2 or 3 months before they're supposed to have the child and saying, hey, I'd like to sign up for childcare. And they realize they probably have to drive 20 miles away.
Is there a price differential for infants compared to getting closer to preschool age?
Yes. So the before and after school is probably the least expensive, and the most expensive is definitely infants. That has to do with state-mandated teacher ratios. An infant requires 4 infants for 1 teacher, and then the older they get, the more students that a teacher can handle, so it does cost more. We'll take everything from the Excel document, we'll combine it with some of the national standards, because they do it by county. And one of the other interesting things that we found from the county data is that we're actually, McLean County is the 4th highest county in the state, behind Kane County and DuPage and another one. So we'll combine those into one, and then we'll push that out into one document.
Why is McLean County the 4th highest in the state?
I really believe it has to do with our annual median income. And that's what a lot of housing developers look at. That's what a lot of retailers look at. And it's just as a whole, we do make really good money here. However, the starting salaries for some of the people that are having kids, we're not at the AMI. And that's where some of the struggles be coming. And so because people are paying more in other positions, it is an opportunity. We're all fighting over the same workforce, and you have to pay more to make up for that. So it is a combination of the cost of living here, plus the wages to compete.
Has it had a measurable effect on the business development climate?
That one is, I want to follow up with an economic impact to find out how many people are staying home, which is the next step. So we have done the supply side. The next survey that we want to do was a demand side study, because that's the part we don't know. And I think it's going to be much harder to do, to get in front of current or prospective parents to find out, would they go back to the workplace, and then try to put a dollar value to every worker if they would go back. There's a tipping point. There's a point where you start to realize if it's a $5,000 to $10,000 difference, you probably just want to stay home with your own kids. So is it really worth the time of going to work?
So how do you make this actionable for what you do?
So for us at the EDC, we've seen some best practices. There's one, I think it's called the tri-state model, where it's actually the government, the major employers, and the parents split the tuition 3 ways. And that's been successful from what I've seen. That gets people to go back to the workforce.
Which government? The local governments? The state? How is it funded?
I believe it was local governments that put in for that.
And how much do they put in each year?
They split it 3 ways, so I don't know how much it was allocated for that. That's something that when we start looking at the solution side, that we will definitely define to see if that's something we want to participate in.
Are there other potential models that should be looked at?
Just speeding up the background checks. There's another issue where people want to become a teacher, and it can take up to 4 months to get a background check. In the meantime, they take another job. That's something very small. That's probably a process at the state level or using a different agency. I'm not sure. But that's another one. The other one that I've seen is where the community will offer up a building. So the building is free, so the rent's free, so you're lowering the operating costs. Another one that we've seen, it's more at a level for the school districts, and this one could cut everybody's prices in half, and that is if they did something similar to Olympia. I know District 87's talked about this, where they add preschool. So even if it's not for the full day, even just a little bit, it could be for 3 or 4 year olds. And that will also get people back in the workforce sooner. The other one would be coming up with some type of stipends for the teachers to get more people interested in the career. because, like I mentioned earlier, there's better earning potential in other careers.
Okay, devil's advocate. If the community is having difficulty convincing municipal bodies to pony up larger packages of incentives to create new housing, how is the community going to buy into the idea of government subsidies for childcare?
I think we got to look at going back to the economic impact of what that worker is. So if that worker having more income at home does come back to them in either property taxes or sales taxes, we should be able to show a return on investment on that side. The other side is really thinking like a futurist and projecting out the future. We're hearing anecdotally, which is why we need to do demand, that people are staggering their births until, or adoptions, until one student is out because you can't afford two students at $2,000 a month.
That's Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council Director Patrick Hoban. He says birth rates have slowed in McLean County, but he says it's not just a local problem. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Join us again next time. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.